power this morning. So what I do with those files is I convert them to MP4s in iTunes, and I post them on the website, so you can listen to my lectures after the fact by going to the website. This doesn't mean you can cut lecture. It means that if you've missed them, you can usually survive. The labs are pretty much coordinated through here only. I show you this slide now just simply to show that there is a lab use policy, and I'd like you all to take a look at that. It pretty much governs how you use and access the labs. We're quite lucky in that the labs that we have are very well equipped. In fact, we replaced pretty much every one of the machines over the summer and upgraded every machine. We've got all new software licenses. And the Star Lab, the lab where we're going to do the bulk of the work, is really, I believe, quite impressively well equipped right now. Okay, so here's my office. It's over in Ellison Hall. Here's my email. My office hours are, in fact, 2 to 4 Mondays, not 1 to 3. We're going to have lectures here Mondays and Wednesdays, 5 to 6:15. You'll get used to this 1 hour, 15-minute format. It's quite a nice format. And this is Theatre and Dance West. I assume that's what the W is. 1701, I'd never been in this room before. It's actually quite a nice room, other than the fact that you all seem so far away. It's better than some of the rooms I've had to teach this class in recently. Okay. The textbook has a website for the class, in addition. If you go and buy the textbook for the class, this one, Getting Started with GIS, and open it up, there is a scratch-off on the first page with a unique code in there that allow you to log into the Pearson website and get quite a lot of materials from the book, including practice exam questions, slides. I've embellished my own slides. These are the generic ones. But a lot of other support material in from the text is available there. Okay, as far as grading is concerned, this class is pretty much half theory and half practice. And it's always a very delicate balance between the two. The theory we're going to cover here in lecture, although we do have a few practical matters to discuss as well in the course of the quarter. The practice part comes by doing hands-on assignments using a piece of software. We're going to use, I'll talk about the software later, but the sort of workhorse software that we're going to be using is ESRI's ArcGIS. In our case, version 9.3, and there's a little lesson in that since we'll have to upgrade for next time. So there's the course website. Feel free to go to it. Most information you're going to need to find is already there. So let's go back here and do that. Okay, so support materials and so on. There are tons more things to support you on the web as far as GIS is concerned. I mean, really, if you had to rely on just the textbook materials, you'd be lost occasionally. GIS.com is just one example of dozens and dozens of different websites that provide information about GIS, how to use it, what it is, and so on. Many classes have all of their course material up on the internet, so there's no shortage of material. I usually begin the quarter by Googling the words geographic information systems, and I usually get about 1.6 million hits now, so it's no shortage of material out there. This, however, is new. If you decide that you don't want to buy this book and pass it on to your children and their children because it's such a landmark textbook in its field, you can take this option, which I only just found out about. This is fairly new. About 3 or 4 major publishers have just signed up a deal with this commercial entity called Courses. I don't know if it's Course Smart or Courses Smart, or whether it's meant to be a combination of the two. But you can go to this website, log in, and sign up. And I don't believe it costs any money to sign up. But then, just like on Amazon, we can find books and buy them, and they mail it to you. On this one, you can find books and buy them for about half the list price, but you buy a digital copy of the book for 180 days rather than the paper copy of the book. And the good news is that they are supporting the iPad and the iPhone. So if you really do want to read the textbook on your iPhone, you can do so. Now, just to prove it, I got myself a login, and here's the first page of the first chapter of the textbook. I'm not trying to sell this. I have no financial interest in this whatsoever. I'm just interested in people enjoying the class. One of the things that you can do, it's a fully indexed and searchable PDF, so you can search for keywords in the PDF reader and so on. And then it supports this additional set of tools here that allow you to print chapters or pages of the book, to mark them up, to have a digital highlighter so that you can highlight the text and save that, and keep your own note sets that you can print, and all these kinds of things if you choose to do so. So it's quite a useful, it seems like quite a useful and relatively inexpensive alternative to buying the textbook. Okay, what are we going to do in class? We're going to do the following. We're going to have a series of lectures. I'll be doing those. We'll have a few guest lecturers to try and cover the breadth of the field. And as I said, we'll be doing that Monday and Wednesday in here. There will be readings, and the readings are assigned on the course curriculum. Basically, it follows this textbook rather closely, funnily enough, because I wrote it. It also has a series of labs, and one of the nice things we did last year is we formalized the labs and also published them as a manual. So this you can buy bundled with the textbook, and this pretty much has a step-by-step procedure for every one of the labs in the class, and copies of the assignment sheets that you're going to have to fill out to be graded on them. So I think this is very important, and you're going to want a copy of it to help yourself through the class. We'll be doing evaluation. You'll evaluate. Yes?
So the lab book, if we did the electronic copy or the textbook, can you buy the lab book separate?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know the answer to that. I know you can buy the lab book separately because I happened to see it on Amazon this morning. You were first. Second, brother. Okay.
Are the lab books useful? Because I know people have taken this class in the past. But how do I get directly?
The lab books should... Oh, you mean over the summer? Because the only time the class has been offered with these lab books was summer session this year. This only came out in about May, so it's relatively hot off the press. Another one? Yeah, it's a new edition. This is the fifth edition, getting started with GIS. That's how I spent my last year, writing a new edition.
Will that book continue through the series, like
BNC? The answer to that is no. This is a textbook specific for the first class. You'll find that it's relatively complete, so it's going to be a good reference source. But my good child does 176B, and he uses his book. That's sort of a position of privilege to be in. Well, he and other people's, but Paul Longley and so on. Okay? Evaluations I was talking about. We'll have the labs, and the labs are partitioned in a kind of strange way. We're actually going to do, I believe it's 8, but they're packaged in 5 chunks. So some weeks you'll be working on 2 labs in a given time period. They're deliberately sized so that some of them are a little bit longer and you get a lot more time for. We've also timed it so that you won't get any new labs over the midterm period or during dead weeks. So you'll have time to work up and complete the labs as we move through the course of the quarter. This is the start of the sequence. 176A is Introduction to GIS. 176B is Technical Issues in GIS, which covers pretty much the same material but in a lot more depth, spends a lot more time on things like representation of data. And 176C, which I will teach in the spring, is a practical class in which students do form into groups and do projects. And I actually have my first meeting on projects today with the campus emergency planners. They're very interested in having students in 176C work on doing some campus readiness for earthquakes and risks. So we may do some of those projects. Okay. My personal goal is to balance the theory and practice. And what you'll find is that there's a real danger of just getting sucked into typing keys on the computer and working through the labs and not really stepping back and understanding what it is that you're learning. So I'm trying to complement the hands-on part in the lab with the lecture part that we'll get here on Mondays and Wednesdays. And I would say that this class has quite a track record. I believe it's one of the better ones in the whole country. Proven success. We're still employing students directly out of this class, seniors, in GIS jobs in the middle of the worst recession in living memory. Okay, this is what I expect of you over the course of the quarter. Do attend lecture, even though I give you so much support material. You know, as Woody Allen said, being there is 80% of success is showing up. As they say, 65% of all statistics are made up on the spot. But maybe another example of that. But, you know, do come along. I mean, I think we've got a decent teaching space. It's a reasonable hour. It won't be 100 degrees every Monday or Wednesday. Do use the support materials. It's between being able to Google, Wikipedia, and so on, the amount of support material is just extraordinary. And it's very directed, and it's very useful. Do read the text. One of my reviewers of the fourth edition, I was very proud of this fact, said that they felt that it was a conversation with the students, not a standard textbook. And I'm very happy that it's still read that way. So I have tried to make it interesting and readable. So I have worked on that quite a bit. It's quite important that you attend lab. If you start to miss labs and get behind on them, you're going to seriously damage your grade. And playing catch-up in this class is very hard to do because the time demanded, the lab time that you're going to need to put in is quite good. It's quite high. I mean, do the labs in sequence because they're very carefully designed that, say, lab 5 it'll simply say, are we going to do again what we did in lab 2? And if you don't remember that, it's on page so-and-so. So it sort of assumes that you're going to learn progressively. You're going to build on the knowledge that you get from one lab to use in the next lab. Be questioning and inquisitive. Question authority. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. I say things that are wrong sometimes just to see if anybody's noticed. And question us in lecture. Certainly be ready for questions in lab. Ah, Grant is here. You want to wave and introduce yourself? Grant McKenzie, the other TA. Delighted that both of my TAs have quite extensive experience in GIS, so they're very knowledgeable and bring a lot of teaching and real-world experience into the classroom. So be ready with your questions in lab. If you want to use the sounding boards of your fellow students and the TAs and myself, the Gaucho Space supports a discussion forum, and I've set up a discussion forum for each one of the assignments. Okay, so material that's specific to each assignment can be its own separate path within the discussion. Do study for your exams. Makes an enormous difference. And, you know, keep a sense of humor and try and have some fun while we're doing this. It won't seem like that at 2 o'clock in the morning the day before your assignment's due, but, you know, try and keep that smile on your face. Okay. Brief pause for questions. Yes?
Is there a lab due this week?
Is there a lab due this week? Is there a lab due this week? No. First week is... the first two labs, I think we've got two weeks for, and the first one is rather gentle. It's sort of to get you started in learning about systems and how to use them, how to use the lab. What you will need for the first labs is access to the labs, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that separately. If your section's already met, you've been handed one of these sheets that Yihong is holding up here. This is because we use a card entry system to the Star Lab. The procedure is that if you take one of these forms, fill it out with your identity information, the department scans it, it's signed by our executive officer, and then returned to you, and I was hoping to do some of those tonight, but they're not ready. By Wednesday or when your lab meets this week, we could have them back to you. You then take your completed form with $15 to Building 300, which is the police office on campus, and they will, after standing in line for a little while, no doubt, they will take your photograph, they'll ask you for a digital signature, when you buy something, like when you buy something on a credit card, and will hand you an ID card that's good to get you into the Star Lab. If you've already got one of these cards that you use for another geography class, we can just add the extra lab requirements to it. It can open multiple doors. Oh, excellent point, yeah. Flash drives are going to be rather important. The way the machines work in the Star Lab is that so many students use them, and so much stuff gets on the hard drive for each of the machines, that we have a program that automatically wipes out the hard drive on every machine once a week, and then reinstalls an image of all the software again. So if your precious Lab 3 files that have to be turned in are sitting on a particular machine, don't expect that they're going to be there the next time you come into the lab. However, if you do carry one of these things around, I'm beginning to think of this as my memory. I'm still waiting for the USB port so I can just plug it directly into here, and then I can know everything. Not very expensive. I recently bought a 32 gigabyte drive. So, all right, this is, one of these is... This is not the one I wanted. Must be this one. Okay. So this is some materials relevant to the lab, so I'll go over these. Indy Hirt put this material together, who's the author of this lab manual. Again, this is also on the website. So there'll be five labs, and each is worth 10% of your grade. So 10% of your grade is one letter grade, okay, so it can make a big difference. What are you going to learn? Well, we're going to learn a lot of ArcGIS desktop, and in fact, we're going to spend most of our time in a module of it called ArcMap. I'll explain what the software is in just a second. But we're also going to look at some other open source software that that we can all share and use. So we integrate these other tools in kind of to soup it up and make it a little bit more fun. We're going to use something called actually OpenGeoda, which is the open source version of the geographical data analysis package, which is really quite sophisticated and can do some pretty neat stuff. We're going to use Google Earth. Google Earth is quite an important tool for geographic reasoning. It's a very good way of displaying your results. And we'll use it and be writing KML and KMZ files in one of the very early assignments and then later on in the quarter. Okay, and the goal of Lab 1 is just simply to become familiar with the software, to learn the ins and outs and the various parts. And that actually takes a little bit more time than you think. It's a rather complex piece of software. It has whole sections. It has literally thousands of different functions. It takes sort of a career to become a super expert on it, but you can get functional very quickly. Lab 2, we're going to become familiar with spatial data and spatial referencing systems. Now the goal, ideally, spatial referencing systems have been introduced in Geography 12. We're in this sort of halfway step of requiring Geography 12 as input for this class. Well, that's kind of interesting. Let's have a show of hands. Who's taken Geography 12? Okay, that's good. You're going to find yourselves at a distinct advantage in the first half of the quarter, and I'm going to have to revisit some of the stuff about projections, coordinate systems, geodesy, and so on, that I also cover in Geography 12. Lab 3, we're going to be creating our own data and asking questions about the data. In the textbook, we have a data example from NOAA about severe storm events, tornadoes, in the United States, and we're going to be using that data for some of the analyses. But then we'll also be using data that's already out there on the web, because going out and finding data, bringing it in, and getting it into the software environment where you can do your own analysis is a very important thing to learn about GIS. So asking questions, doing queries, and structuring analyses is important. Lab 4, we work on tabular data, and we look at displays and do a little bit more on cartography. A couple of chapters in the book about how to design and lay out effective maps, we'll cover that. Indy calls them cool maps. They are indeed cool. And then in lab 5, we take this next step where the output mechanism, rather than simply being a static map that you might print on a sheet of paper, the output becomes something that you're going to post out onto the World Wide Web. And I can give you a tangible example of that. Here's, if we go up here to earth.gog.ucsb.edu/ICM for interactive campus map, you can see what's come about as a result largely of student work in 176 series culminating in 176C. This was refined and put on the server by some staff and graduate students, the bulk of this was created by people who were sitting where you are today a year ago, but actually in another building. But this is really pretty impressive piece of software. And it reflects the fact that most web output these days is on the web. We include Isla Vista and West Campus and some of the surrounding area. And we can do things like, here's an interesting thing. Let's say that you wanted to find geography 176A. Oops, and you could actually type. You could do a course query here. If we hit go and, we should highlight on the map. Let's try something else. Let's put my name in there. It should highlight on the map exactly where the class is being taught. Yes, there it is. And the building number, and there's lots of additional information in there. This only works for geography courses right now. It's got parking list on there. It supports a large number of interesting layers like eateries in Isla Vista and so on. And here's one of my favorites, the measured strength of the wireless signal on campus. This was another student project. They went out and actually measured the wireless signal strength throughout that rectangle and have it posted here. Okay, so we won't actually be doing something this fancy, but we'll be well on the way there over the course of this this class. Okay, the structure of the labs, the way the labs are organized, is consistent. Indy is a former she's a licensed GIS instructor in the past and has a bit of a career in instructional material designs. They're generally step-by-step, so it's incremental with checkpoints to make sure you've done the right things by the right locations. The lab manual has been tried and tested. This particular material has now been through this class 3 times. So we think we've found almost everything in it, just in time for ESRI to introduce version 10 of the software and this to be all out of date and needing to be redone completely. Indy is the author. If you know Indy, she's one of the graduate students in geography. Now, posted on the Goucherspace site for the class are the PDF files that are the same as the content of the lab manual, and it helps to pop those up in one window and be able to scroll through and read them. And a series of templates, Word doc files, which include the questions that you need to answer and then leave spaces into which you can type your answers to the questions. So it's all pretty nicely structured. And this is Indy's plea, please try and avoid paper. One of the reasons we went through putting this on paper is that from our prior experiences, when you handed out a lot of PDF files, the first thing everybody did was print them. And the geography printer would run 24 hours a day for the first week of the quarter. And then most of that paper would get thrown away in the course of the next few days. So don't print, please. Try and go digital and use the digital content. Okay, Goucherspace is there. It's at goucherspace.ucsb.edu. You're probably using it for other classes as well. If you registered for this class, you're automatically in Goucherspace with this class in your class list. So you just simply click on Geography 176A, Intro Geog Inf Sys Fall 2010, and it will take you into the section of Gaucho space. This is what it looks like. Generally speaking, it's structured by week, and even though I've got the whole class already planned and on here, I hide the content for a week until we get there, because I don't really want you to do labs in advance. I want them all to be done together. And what you'll see will be a series of things like the download for lab one, the discussion board for lab one, the labs and what you need to turn in and so on will all be posted there. So this is a place to go to get information about the labs and how to do them. Okay, so here's an example of the discussion forum. So if you go to this is why I don't like Moodle. It's kind of dull. I mean, they obviously don't have many web designers working for them. But just go there and add a new question, and various threads of the different questions will be displayed if they're on the same topic. So the entry will look like this. Where can I get a printed copy of the labs? See, discussion items. This is by Indy. If you want to put a photograph of yourself on the page, like on Facebook or whatever, you can. Any replies will be here. You know the format. This is the way most discussions groups work. And don't be afraid of posting things on there. Often a question might get asked and there might be a series of replies that are very informative. And sometimes an idea is thrashed through that comes back to be a question in lecture, which is great. Okay. I used to use iClickers. Who loves iClickers? See, no one. I don't like them either, so I'm not going to be using them. Unfortunately, in the bookstore, Indy Hurt used iClickers for 176A when she taught it over the summer, and they just rolled the requirement over to this fall. So if anybody's bought one explicitly for this class, my apologies, that's the bookstore's fault, take it back and they will give you a refund, okay, because I'm not going to use them for this class. After trying them out for a year, my chief conclusion is that, yes, they do add some interaction that a few people consider entertaining, but they sacrifice about 10 to 15 minutes of my lecture time for each lecture, and I'm not prepared to sacrifice that. So no iClickers. In my other class, I call them uClickers, and it's called putting your hand up. Yeah?
Maybe you're talking about downloading the labs. Is that only if you don't buy the little book or the lab book?
If you download them, what you're downloading is exactly what's in the tear-off sheet part of the book.
Correct. All right. Cool. We don't have to download
it. Most people, I mean, the value of this, we've tried to do it without this, with it all online, but everybody always says, I want my own copy to take home and have in my dorm room. And yes, indeed, you can do some parts of the labs anywhere on the internet, so it'll give you access outside of lab time. Okay, the lab is called the Star Lab. It's named for a former faculty member, Jeff Starr, who died of cancer in about, I believe it was 1992. So the lab's a bit of a memorial to him. Note that we have works of art in every one of our labs in geography, and the work of art in the Star Lab is Jeff Starr's memorial quilt. So do take a minute to look at it. It's really quite beautiful. It's made by his family. It's in 2620 Ellison Hall. That's the north wing of Ellison Hall, the one that faces the big circular Campbell Hall. It's pretty comfortable, air-conditioned, useful for today. It does have some protocols for use, so be aware of that. My own list is on the website for the class, but there's also a list of protocols that you'll find posted in the room, and please follow those rules and regs. Three large classes are using that lab this quarter, so I predict it's going to be quite interesting. Now, we do have a couple of other labs, but this is the most students we've ever tried to put in that lab at the same time. And access is controlled, as I said, by the swipe cards. You aren't going to need to get one of those if you want to get in outside of class time. Basically, there's a little black scan box on the outside of the door. If the light on it is green, you can just open the door and walk in. And it should be green during the hours assigned to your labs. If it's red, then you need to use your card to enter the lab. If you just hold the card anywhere near the box, it will go beep, the door will open, or at least it'll, you'll hear the lock release, and the light will turn green for a second. You now have, I believe it's 1 minute to close the door again, okay? And you, trust me, you don't want to hear what happens if the alarm goes off. It's really loud and really obnoxious. So just make sure the door's closed. The biggest problem is that the door will close and then not snap all the way shut. Just make sure it's shut. It's much easier that way. Okay, so I've talked about some of this. The access forms are really quite important if you want to get into the building outside of class time. Allison is pretty frequently used, so generally speaking, almost any time of the day or night you can get into Allison. They do lock the door on the weekends, but generally speaking, there's always a graduate student or two coming in and out that's willing to let you in to go up to the Star Lab. So we can pretty much give you 24/7 access to the labs. I've already covered this. Oh, it's 30 seconds. And just a reminder, we have I call the Star Cam. And we have webcams in every one of our classrooms. So you are on screen in Dylan's office when you are using the Star Lab. Okay. All right. That took me about as long as I expected, which is good. Another pause for questions? Yes. Correct. In fact, there's actually a little bit more in the lab book because there are 10 assignments in the lab book. We tried to make it a little bit more comprehensive because some schools have longer semesters, and you know, 13 and 15 weeks, and we only have 10 weeks. So we're actually going to be doing 8 out of the 10. Oh, okay, cool. Does the sound carry okay in here, by the way? Good. All right, so I'm going to start talking about the labs themselves. It's kind of odd to talk about labs in lecture, but there's some material that you really need in the first week, and it's going to help. You're going to learn a lot more of this in the course of doing the first lab, but I always say lecturing on giving a lab is kind of like giving a lecture on how to swim. It's like useless. You can understand the principles, but it's not the theory that's going to prevent you from drowning. But anyway, I'll go through the motions here, okay? So the piece of software we're primarily going to be using in class is ArcGIS, and what I want to do is cover some of the structure of the software, a little bit of the history and its organization, how it's put together. So it is Environmental Research Systems Institute, founded in the 60s, I believe, by this guy, Jack Dangermond, who still owns the company outright with his wife. It's now a Fortune 200 company, and they've never issued shares, so it's owned outright by Jack Dangerman and his wife. There's their building in Redlands, California. If you go and visit Jack, he'll very, very proud to point out that the hut which they first started in was about as big as this lecture theater, and it now, they call it a campus, and it actually occupies a big proportion of the floor space of Redlands, California. They just gave him permission to block off streets to make it even more of a campus. It is the leading piece of software, at least in the United States. It tends to be less frequently used outside the United States, largely because it tends to be fairly expensive outside the US. But as you'll see, different parts of it cost different amounts of money. So we're going to give you hands-on experience in one software package. You, unfortunately, as a cohort, are going to see and get used to version 9.3 in this class, and you're going to go migrate to version 10 as the department migrates to version 10 next quarter. So you'll see some differences. They say it's quite a major rewrite. They also say that it actually makes things a little bit easier, so hopefully you've got that to look forward to. So by doing hands-on, we're going to give an introduction to some of the issues involved. And the issues are things that you face regularly. Problems with data analysis and data gathering, data collection, uncertainty of information, communication, errors, and how you deal with them. And then the problems of software use, primarily problems of user interface, of errors, of tracking and inventorying, and all the things that we need to do. when we use software effectively. It's going to reinforce the lectures, so ideally I'll be lecturing on the same thing that you'll be doing a lab about at the same time. So you'll be getting the theory and the practice hand in hand. I hope this is going to allow you to learn more about theory. It's going to also make you appreciate why it's important to learn about theory. I get criticized a lot for the book and for this class in introducing so much theory early. I think it's critical. It's what's still going to be there when the software changes. And of course, the labs are also a means to assess your student achievement. And I would have to say that by the third class, 176C, most people in this class have become so proficient with using the software that they become indispensable. We've had people recruited and hired right out of the class as they graduate. We've had people who've also taken internships get themselves into a position where they're so valuable that they're hired as soon as they graduate. And this happens on a regular basis. This is kind of an ugly diagram, but it's the big picture of everything, almost quite literally. Let's come at it from the internet end. Here's the internet over here. The components that we're going to deal with: databases. You can stick data for a particular project together and the files on the computer. There's the files right over there. But eventually, the project is going to get so big, or you're going to work on something that's so complex, perhaps with multiple users, that you're going to need to put your data inside of a database and let industrial strength software take care of data management. So we're going to learn a little bit about that. Esri software uses this idea of geodatabases. We're going to talk about those in a little while. It meshes primarily with Oracle and SQL Server and some other database software to do most of the heavy lifting. But again, we're only going to meet that incidentally in this class. More about it in the next class. The particular types of files we're going to use, I am going to cover right now. So I'll give you just a basic introduction to them. But they fall into these categories: personal geodatabases, shapefiles, coverages, grids, and some other stuff like TINs. And ArcPad is a mobile application that works with the Esri software that allows you to take much of the functionality of a GIS and put it on a handheld computer so that you can take it into the field or link it with a GPS receiver. So we can get quite a lot of strength through ArcPad. I've done some very successful projects with ArcPad, so I like to put it. Here's some of the server side, or the sort of client server architecture side stuff. ArcServer is the new version of their service architecture. It used to be called ArcIMS for doing their internet browsability and availability. Their spatial database engine, or SDE, is their database tool that allows large scale manipulation of huge data sets across the internet. It's very easy once you want to analyze a whole state or a whole country to get so many records that your normal statistical packages just blow up. So these are designed for working with those. And then we have the five components along the top that you interact with as users of the software. A web browser, just a standard web browser. Oftentimes you're interacting with the Esri software and you don't realize it. That campus map I just showed you, for example, is running on a department server. But you access it through a web browser just the same way you access anything else. Google Maps, Google Earth, Bing Maps, and so on. These are just examples of browser-based geographic information software. Arc Explorer is Esri's own attempt to compete with Google Earth and Google Maps and so on. We won't be spending much time on that, but it does allow your way of posting out or distributing your data once you've assembled it for various different reasons. We will be dealing quite a bit with the three tools or three components that are in these three boxes with the circle around them, so the ellipse, I should say. Those are called Arc Info, Arc Editor, Arc View, but each of those share the three major components that we'll introduce right here. So when you sit down and launch the software, typically you're using this piece first, Arc Map. That's the interface through which you lay out, design, and draw maps on the screen and manage some of their content. But you'll very quickly realize that these other two components are very important too. ArcCatalog is a way of sorting data sets, of doing bulk transformations on data sets, and on previewing or browsing to see if the data sets that you're looking at are actually those that you want. It also is capable of working either within your own personal geodatabases or across the internet. So if somebody else on the other side of the world has the data that you want to use, you can just simply connect to their server and use it without downloading it onto your machine. And then at the top there we have the ArcTools. The ArcTools is just a sort of a big toolbox, a collection of pieces of software that often work completely independently outside of the other two components, that simply go and get a data set and do something to it. Transform the coordinate system, generalize the lines, merge things together, check for consistency, thousands of different operations. So these are the kind of like the three legs of the stool: ArcMap, ArcCatalog, and ArcTools. And we're going to be using all three of these over the course of the quarter. Here is ArcMap. Typically, it consists of a series of windows. One of them is displaying either the map as it currently its current working version exists, kind of like this, or as we've laid it out professionally to be printed or permanently captured in what's called a layout, like this. So we can manage both of those capabilities. In both formats, we have a series of information, usually in a window on the left-hand side of the map, of the window space, that deals with what's being shown, what operations have been done, how the data's been classified, what color schemes we're using for the display, and so on. The other thing that we can do in ArcMap is get relevant information. So we can, let's say, click on a block, a city block or a house in this database at the top and retrieve the information associated with that house. So just usually that's a little query button. We can click on the query button, point to something, and pop up a table or a summary report of all the information associated with that feature. And as we'll see in Wednesday's lecture, that's really one of the defining things that makes GIS useful. And we can also do simple queries like buffering transformations or searches within the context of ArcMap. So if we've got a database, let's say, that consists of all the houses in the neighborhood, like the one at the top, and we're only interested in seeing that all the houses that have sold in the last 6 months, as you might see on, say, the Zillow website, then we can do a simple query that says, go and find the field that's the date of the sale and look at it to see whether or not it dates within the last 6 months. And if it does, return that as a successful query. So there's ArcMap. ArcMap is sort of, it'll become familiar and sort of your friend in many ways. Here's ArcCatalog. It looks a little bit more like you might expect for a catalog. It's kind of a little bit more databasey and tabley than ArcMap, because we're not necessarily seeing all of the graphics. Some of the things we can do in ArcCatalog is preview data at a coarser scale, so make sure that we've got the right data set, the one that we're interested in using. So we can do previews. We can look at the tables associated with data. So we have maps and the tables that hold the attributes associated with data. We can look at the tables with ArcCatalog relatively straightforwardly. And we can look at what's called metadata. Metadata is information about data. So metadata that needs to go along with the data set might be as simple as the date that the information was created, or the person who created it, person or the agency. Or it might contain information about accuracy or map projection or coordinate system that is directly useful for being able to use the data for our purposes. So being able to access the metadata is very important. Here, for example, it's telling us the latitude and longitude range of the data that's being displayed, and the coordinate system in which the data is being held. All very critical stuff. And then ArcToolbox. ArcToolbox is pretty much always available when you're in ArcMap just by clicking on the little toolbox icon, as is also ArcCatalog, although they launch as separate pieces of software. And ArcToolbox is literally an almost incomprehensible list. It's got sort of a hierarchy structure to it, but the hierarchy is not according to any logic that I know. Until you've worked with it for a while and know where things are, it can be a little bit confusing, and the most useful thing is the manual, which tells you what functions do what. So it's a set of functions, and they're classified by type. So here we've got a set of tools called conversion tools. I can click on the little where it says minus right now, to it'll be plus to expand the list of things that are available. Those do things like export to, from a shapefile, export from a geodatabase. We've got some help functions and so on, data management tools. One of those handles map projections, for example, is projections. But when we click on these icons to set up operations, we usually launch a standalone piece of software that works outside of ArcMap or ArcCatalog, in which we'll get usually a simple sequential query. So what data set do you want to do a transformation on? What transformation do you want to do? Where do you want to put the output? Right, so straightforward. So let's say my input data set is in latitude and longitude, and I want to convert it into UTM. Might be one little function to do that, and there it is. So ArcToolbox is essentially a list of functions, of transformations and changes that we can make to the data set. And it has tools for most of the commonly used tasks. Not a complete set of tools, but all of the tools that you will probably meet in the beginning of the class. Using ArcCatalog, we can do some things that are of interest. So when I request ArcCatalog here over on the left-hand side, I've gone to a file on my local machine that's actually on the E drive, and I can see the function, the stuff associated with that file on my drive. And that's how we're going to be using much of the software for the class. So your data sets are going to come ready and available for you, and you're going to be able to unload them, download them. That's not always going to be the case. Often they're going to be somewhere else out of the internet. So this allows you to make connections to database systems or internet servers where we can go out and trawl around the internet looking for the data that we need. And then once we get there, we can connect directly to that server and use the data on that server as if it were on our local drive. Very handy thing to be able to do. A little bit of history. I always find history is informative and helps to explain things. Esri's original product was called ArcInfo, Arc/Info, because it was two pieces of software glommed together, basically. Arc was a set of graphical routines for drawing things, and it really, mostly it drew arcs, that's why it was called Arc. But it handled drawing things mostly in a vector model. That's the one of the models that we're going to meet pretty soon, next week. They bought an extremely clunky early remote relational database management system called Info, and literally just built the bridge to put the two together. So when I first started using the software, a long time ago now, when you wanted to do something with Info, you actually had to get out of Arc and launch a completely different piece of software to do your data management, and then put the results back into the display routines. And that was based on what's called a coverage model. And the coverage, as we'll see, is simply a way of collecting multiple layers together into a single data record. It went through versions 1 through 7, starting in about 1980. I saw it originally on Prime computers, mini computers, which were twice the size of that console over there. And version 1 through 7 up to 1999. It evolved its own programming language called the Arc Macro Language, or AML, and whole generations of people learned how to write AMLs. And AML is basically a scripting language that allows you to take commands for Arc Info and put them in a file that you can then edit and then tell the system to do everything at once rather than just doing them step by step. Okay, so that takes us up to 2000. But we've got a sort of parallel world down here. Esri was being asked to produce software for the newly growing PC market, and the story is they took three or four guys and put them in a shed and said, okay, write some software for the PC. They came out with something called ArcView in 1994. It went through several versions. 1 through 3, and it was eventually abandoned in 1999. Why will become obvious in a few minutes. ArcView was based on a shapefile model, and shapefiles have outlasted ArcView because they're an extremely popular format. They're now open source utilities for reading and writing them. They're very simple to use, but they're what so-called spaghetti models. Okay, and you'll learn the importance of that in a week or two. They had another scripting language called Avenue, which they eventually abandoned, but it was a very nice object-oriented language that was quite popular with people. You can imagine that if you support a programming language for a piece of software for 10 or 15 years and then decide to abandon it, your users are not very happy when that happens. So it died and was reborn as ArcGIS, based on this geodatabase model, with version 8 of the software, dating from about 2000 onwards. And instead of AML and Avenue, they decided to go with a commercial programming language for their scripting, Visual Basic. And it still uses Visual Basic. VBA, Visual Basic for Applications. And we started with version 8, and we've slowly incremented every other year or so up to 9.3. Version 10 was released at the user conference in July in San Diego, and they made a big fuss about it, and they're trying to push schools to implement it. We've held back a little bit because we want to make the transition across the board when we do so. There's some old numbers, 2004. They've sold about 160,000 licenses by 2004. And claimed 1.2 million users, and I believe that. They hold an annual users conference in used to be in Palm Springs, but now it's in San Diego because they outgrew the convention center in Palm Springs. Every year it attracts between 12 and 13,000 people. Now that's about 3 to 4 times the size of the Association of American Geographers annual conference. It's an enormous number of people who are involved in using this piece of software. Very popular, and it's used worldwide. Okay, so a few concepts, a little bit of that theory. And a very important thing to understand if we're going to go into GIS and we're going to spend much of a lecture talking about this idea is the idea of data modeling. So the real world is extremely complicated. You know, it's got blades of grass and concrete blocks 4 inches thick and walls and retaining structures and doorways and forests and stuff is immensely complicated. Way more complicated than the vehicles that we have for representing things inside of computers. So what we do is we simplify reality, we build a model of reality, and then we deal with encoding that model of reality in digits and numbers inside the computer. So why do we do this? Well, we want to take data about the real world, the outline of a forest, the line of a retaining wall, the thickness of a piece of concrete, the location of the exits from this room, and put them into a database so that they can be stored and accessible and available to us and retrieved so we can get them back when we want them. That's a very important thing to be able to do. And basically we've got two types of things that we need to relate together. And you're going to hear this several times. I know it sounds simple, but I'm going to sort of beat you over the head with it. First, we've got things in the world with their geographic locations. So we could say that this end of the retaining wall has this latitude and longitude, or the edges of this forest are the following set of coordinate pairs. And then things have attributes. And we put those we put attributes in tables. So attributes are things like the thickness of the concrete, the breaking strength of the concrete, the number of trees in the forest, the number of board feet of lumber you can get from those trees, all this kind of extra stuff that needs to go along with the geographic reality. So how we design this, the set of primitives, you might say, is very much about data modeling, and GIS gives us some pre-supported models that we can then mold for our own use. So we have, ultimately, we have to take all these things and turn them into numbers, and we have to stuff those numbers into files, because it's files that computers understand, folders and files. So the traditional model, the coverage-based model, was based upon what are called file models, and these were coverages and shape files. For the ARCs, the geographic information, This was developed under ArcInfo. It was a very complex structure. It had a proprietary format originally, so you couldn't operate them between different GISs. It originally used info tables for the attribute information, but it still has an export format that is very common. So the E00 file format, you'll still find coverage files out there from, you know, 30 years ago that people are still using. And alternatively, there was the shapefile view. It was developed for ArcView, which we just described. It's a very simple structure. It's in the public domain, so you can look up the specifications for how to write those files very easily. And there are, in fact, shareware databases and software code that allows you to read and write them. And they use a very much simpler way of storing the database information with them. They use DBase, database management files, or DBF tables, which come directly into a spreadsheet, so they're very very accessible. So these are the simpler file-based models. To store data in those, within a coverage, we would simply have an overall coverage that might be, let's say, California, and then we'd have folders within it that represent the different types of information that we have for California. So we might have the outlines of the counties, we might have the census data, they may have something in common, but they're hierarchically structured, and then the various databases that go along with it. The shape files were very much simpler. The shape files simply had three files for each of the different elements of the shape file, generally an SHP file, which contains the actual lines and polygons and things, an SHS or an index file, and this database file, the DBF file, that we can use for storing the table information that goes along with the data. So this was the world up to about 2000. Then we got this geodatabase model that came along with ArcInfo version, or ArcGIS version 8. So there we changed the terminology largely to reflect the fact that these are object-oriented models, object-based models. So a geodatabase is a relational database that's going to store geographic information. So we're going to choose the relational database structure, which we're going to not hear about until just before the midterm, unfortunately, but take it from me, it's the way most large database systems work. And within the geodatabase, we're going to store a feature data set, and a feature data set is simply going to be, we're going to define it as simply a set of feature classes that share the same spatial reference frame. So we're defining the data set by a geometry, and then we're allowing pretty much anything to be placed into it. So we might have this particular geodatabase represented by that symbol, and it might have a series of coverages in it of different types. It might have an element called Texas, and we have lines representing counties, points representing some measured value like evapotranspiration, let's say. So we can have points, lines, areas, attributes, lots of different things, and put them all in the same database together. So what is the geodatabase model itself? Well, it stores geographic data as one shape in a relational database table. We're going to, as I said, we're going to learn about these later on in the quarter, but for now, just assume it's a database. And it actually uses Microsoft Access, you know, really commonly available as part of the Microsoft Office software suite to do most of the single user base management. It calls these personal geodatabases and uses the protocols for Microsoft Access to access them. And then for the getting into the other components, like going across the internet and so on, they use Oracle software, SQL Server, DB2, and some other pieces of software. And these are called enterprise geodatabases. And at the simplest level, they might be groups of people working together, say within an organization that need to share data between different departments. Or they might be literally all users across the world that want to work with common data sets. And the model supports both of these structures and allows their usage. Okay, so here's the whole sort of ball of wax. If we open up the workspace is going to be our overall component that we're going to work on. We need workspace management, because we need check-in and check-out. If we've got many people working on a database, you don't all want to be editing the same database at the same time and then all try and check your corrections in at the same time. You'll all overwrite each other's corrections. If you've ever worked with a group of friends to write a paper in Microsoft Word with track changes, you'll have realized that problem. So we need to handle check-in, check-out. We have the name of the geodatabase, and the little disk drum icon there represents the geodatabase itself. Within it, we have feature data sets, and features can have classes, just as we do in programming. And in this case, we might have different classes that are things like points in geographic space. We might have things like that, like lines that have directions associated with them, like in a river network or a power grid. We may have tables or relationships associated with it. So here we've got a network structure with hydrology, junctions, structure to the network, topology, and so on, all contained within it. So bottom line here, we've got lots of different types of information, some tabular, some representing point features, some lines, some networks. We can glom it all together, bundle it up in a geodatabase, and throw it down as a single entity, as long as it all shares the same geographic region that that we're talking about. So I'll basically say the same thing over again. If we have object classes, that any collection of objects in tabular format have the same behavior and the same attributes. So there's USGS test well outside the Harding School in on the west side of Santa Barbara, and it might correspond to a series of measurements that are made about water quality from the water table on a regular basis. Somebody comes by once a week, once a month, puts a sampler down and pulls some water up from the ground table and then analyzes it, and those results we can put in a table like this. So it might have, you know, 13 samples taken, and this is the mean contaminant rate of the samples, and so on and so on. So a table of all these things bear in common the fact that they refer to that well geographically, and they're features of the water from that well. So they're all properties of the same thing. So a feature class is a collection of the objects that might have tables associated with them. So we could have all of the wells in Santa Barbara County, or all the wells in the United States, now become a feature class of those points that have all the features associated with them. We just collectively put them all together into a single entity. So here are all the elements. So a feature class is an object class, as we just saw, the records for a single well, plus the spatial coordinates, the locations of all the wells that go along with it. Not just one well, all of the wells. So what we're doing here is just building more complex features to represent that geographic reality. We can also have relationships. So a relationship is a database concept. It's a link between things that can be either geographically or non-geographically related together. Here's an example of a relationship. So there's that same water sample from the well, that particular highlighted record, and it refers to parameter 00310. And we can look up that parameter in a completely different table. This one is the water quality parameter table. Now that one's the water quality data from between 1990 and 1994. And we can figure out, oh, this is a particular test that's done for giving a value in milligrams per liter that might do a particular thing. So the results of a particular test done in a lab somewhere, posted in a completely boring spreadsheet file, we can now link back to the geography so that all the data that we got from our testing and its attributes, we can now put together into a common reference base. That's what GIS is going to allow us to do. So we can do things that we weren't necessarily planning on doing. For example, we might decide that a watershed is important for all the well data that we have within that watershed, that it's going to be more related to things within the watershed than, say, things within counties or within neighborhoods, so that we can find links by watershed that wouldn't necessarily have been available to us if we had things structured in some other way, like by counties. Okay, so this kind of relationship and exploring these relationships becomes possible once we go for this object format. We can have networks. Networks is where we just simply link things together. And although we've got a stream network there because we're dealing with well data, and wells and sample points and so on are obviously related to stream networks, you might expect a contaminant, for example, that is detected at a well to flow through the water within a system and eventually reach the the surface water and flow out within the river network. But this is only one type of network. You have networks of fault lines, you have networks of electrical power grids, you have networks of roads that allow us to drive around, we have networks of bike paths. There are networks all over the place within the landscape. And networks are very important because they have nodes within them at the start and the end, and they have linkages, start and end points, and often they have directions associated with movement. There's a big, important difference between a one-way street and a two-way street, and we need to record that information in the database. Okay, more practical stuff here. When you use GIS in our labs, you sit down, you click on the icon to launch ArcGIS. The part of it that you want to use is usually ArcMap. You use ArcMap to launch everything else. And hopefully everything launches accordingly. But what actually happens is something a little bit more complicated. So we have what are called floating seats. We might have some standalone or single-use seats, as we call those ArcViews. But they might reflect the student version of the software, which I hope to be able to order for all of you, so that you can install the software outside of the lab. A floating seat might be you sitting down at one of the workstations in the lab. As soon as you request the software, you do exactly that. A request gets sent to a license manager, which runs on our server for the labs, and the license manager looks at the request and says, how many Esri licenses do I own? How many have already been checked out by people to work on? And if they're available for use, it'll give you a unique code that allows the software to run on your machine. So if you can copy ArcGIS onto your laptop, let's say, it won't work because there's no request to go through to the license server. You can get standalone dedicated versions, but you need a dongle to plug into the back to be able to use them. So the license manager is very important. For one thing, we're charged by how many seats we serve on our servers, and it can be quite expensive. The Esri software currently retails for about $1,500, by the way, for a single seat. You pay $1,500, then they say, you know, it's kind of like, well, that buys you the Volkswagen, but wouldn't you much rather have a Cadillac? And the Cadillac version contains all of these, what are called extensions. And we are going to use extensions in this class. Fortunately, we have them all from ESRI. There's some that you're likely to encounter. The special analyst, which does some of the more gnarly functions to do with analysis and interpolation, things like that. 3D analyst, which allows 3D representation and dealing with topography and building structures and so on. And the geostatistical analyst, which allows you to do kriging and some very fancy interpolation. So on the database side, that also means ArcGrid to support grids and ArcTin, but those are going to come bundled anyway with the software. So when you think you've got all the software down, you run into extensions. Spatial Analyst primarily deals with the analysis of land surface terrain as a grid, so it's got its own data structure. It's part of a feature data set called a grid. It's critical spatial analyst for doing things like drainage areas, stream network connectivity, and for doing some interpolation functions. Grid data sets are regular old data sets, but they consist of not lines drawn in geographic space, but pixels, just like in an image. It's like when you zoom in on a picture, you see that it's just a series of dots. Same thing goes for these grid data sets, so we need to be able to support those. Geostatistical analyst deals with interpolation of points to a grid, so it deals with this issue of taking point-based data and turning it into grids. And the nice thing is it does a sort of error analysis of that process. We can support image data sets as well, so any kind of imagery that we can use that might be, say, in the National Map that we want to bring in and use as our reference base. We have a nice 6-inch image of campus that we often use, for example. We can bring in and use. The 3D analyst allows us to do three-dimensional visualization of buildings or topography, but it uses this triangulated irregular network model, and it supports what's called ArcScene, a separate standalone application that generates three-dimensional views and animation sequences in virtual environments. So lots of TIN data sets and tools for constructing TINs come along with these pieces of software. Okay, Esri being so big as a company has all sorts of useful utilities, including this one. It now provides free access to its virtual campus. So most of its training programs and training utilities and manuals and things that instruct you on particular pieces of software, you can just go to the virtual campus and look it up yourself. You can get their Arc Explorer special browser for free, and there are lots of other good brochures and reference material on the Esri website. Okay, right on time. Any last minute questions? No? Okay. Sorry to give you so much technical material so early, but believe me, it'll help you with your first lab. Okay, so labs will meet this week, and I'll see you again on Wednesday to start the regular lecture series.